Straight Talk on WRHI is presented by Founders Federal Credit Union. Relax, you're with Founders. Now here's Manning Kimmel broadcasting live from Substation 2 on Cherry Road in Rock Hill with Straight Talk, selected by the South Carolina Broadcasters Association as the state's top public affairs program.
And a good afternoon. Welcome into Substation 2, Cherry Road across from Winthrop, for another edition of our Straight Talk broadcast, presented by Founders Federal Credit Union. Relax, you're with Founders. Our thanks to our co-sponsor today, Anderson Griggs Investments at Old Town Rock Hill. Common sense, intelligent advice for conservative investors. Find out more online at AndersonGriggs.com. Our thanks as well to Piedmont Medical Center, a community built on care. Find out more online at PiedmontMedicalCenter.com. And by HighSpeedWeb.net that streams our signal 24/7, 365. Well, State Senator Greg Gregory is with us with what could probably be his last interview here on Straight Talk, because he's decided, I don't want to be a politician anymore. And that's what we're going to be doing today on our Straight Talk program. Senator, thank you for coming up from Lancaster. And I guess you just had enough. After two tours of duty, you're just going to hang it up.
Yeah, I've always certainly enjoyed doing these interviews over the last 20, 25 years or however long it's been. But all politicians, I think, have an expiration date, and I've reached mine, at least for the time being. It's time to let somebody with some new energy, new ideas occupy the seat.
So you have a unique history of having done this twice.
Right.
You might want to explain to the listeners how it came about that you did two tours of duty.
Right. So I was first elected in 1992, and I was the first Republican elected in Lancaster County since Reconstruction. And so I served for 16 years to 2008, decided I'd had enough, and didn't run for another term. Mick Mulvaney took my place through the election, and he served for 2 years and then was elected to Congress. So 2011, I ran for the seat again and kind of came back the hard way through five or six opponents, and I've been in it now for the last 10 years.
And time has come for somebody else.
Yeah, I just don't really have anything left that really that interested in or really want to accomplish, so I think it's time to move on and let somebody else move into the seat.
Well, now you can look back. You've got a pretty interesting track record of stuff that you've worked on. What would you say the top, I don't know, two or three highlights of what you've worked on that actually got through and is
right,
producing some results?
Well, you know, with regard to current issues, it seems like, you know, the front burner issue in recent months has been monuments and, of course, the battle flag, which is probably, you know, the biggest hot button issue I've ever been involved with, was the battle flag, which of course used to fly on top of the State House. It was put up for the centennial of the war and then not taken down when the centennial ended for whatever reasons. But I was first Republican, I think, in the Senate or maybe the legislature to advocate for the battle flag to be brought down, which it was, and put beside the Soldiers Monument until the Charleston Massacre, when we lost our colleague Clementa Pinckney and eight others, and then it was taken off the State House grounds. So that was probably, you know, one of the top issues.
Let me stop you right there. When you became the first Republican to speak out against that flag, mm-hmm, what kind of reaction did you get, if you can remember?
It was a very unpopular decision among my constituents. I've never really had many Black constituents that have brought the issue up to me, but white constituents, many of them are quite unhappy about it. In fact, one put signs on all the telephone poles on Highway 521 that said, "Anybody but Gregory." So I got a couple of those as souvenirs. But I think it was the right decision. I mean, I've studied Civil War history all my life. I've been to many of the battle flags, but many of the battlefields with former Senator John Corzine, who has encyclopedic knowledge of the war. And the flag was put over the dome for the centennial. It should have been taken down at the centennial. Just from the sake of logic, not emotion, that would, I think, render it the correct decision. But unfortunately, you know, through Dylan Roof and others, the battle flag's been co-opted. And I have great respect for the battle flag. And I just recently wrote a column about monuments. You know, in, at Gettysburg, there was one Virginia regiment who had 9 soldiers shot down carrying the battle flag in Pickett's charge. So, you know, the battle flag meant obviously something different to them than what the connotation is today. But unfortunately, the connotation, you know, cannot be overcome in modern society.
So when you take a look, as we continue to talk about this monument issue, with everything that's going on across the country right now, particularly here in the South, what goes through your mind or goes through your gut when you right. when you see what the defacing of these statues, right. tearing down these statues? I mean, I got it how times change, but it seems to me that there's an orderly process right. that one should follow.
Right.
If you want to get a statue out, you know, you go through it in an orderly way. Don't destroy it.
Exactly, and that's the way things, you know, should be done and have to be done in a democracy. I mean, otherwise, you know, you're just giving in to nihilism and this Soviet-like mentality. But the monument issue obviously is a complicated issue, and as part of taking down the battle flag, that came about through the Heritage Act, and through the Heritage Act requires that to move a monument or change a name requires a two-thirds vote of the legislature, and whether you like it or not, that was part of the compromise by duly elected officials. If people don't like the Heritage Act, then they can encourage their elected officials to change it, or they can get new elected officials. But that's, you know, tedious, but that's the way democracy works. As far as my personal opinion on monuments, I think that the vast majority of monuments, especially soldiers' monuments, should be preserved. If you visited battlefields, Civil War battlefields, I mean, you know that there are monuments to both sides on these battlefields. So the problem with the whole take down the monument movement is, where does it stop? I mean, there's no clear line. Are we going to go all the way to, you know, toppling the Washington Monument because Washington owned slaves? But clearly there are some that probably should not stand. I mean, I don't, you know, favor a monument of Jefferson Davis, a political leader of the Confederacy, but I do favor the continued display of soldiers' monuments. In Lancaster County, 88% of the men eligible to serve, which I think was between age 15 and age 49, served. So, I mean, that to me, that monument represents, you know, their enormous sacrifice in the war.
All right, well, we could talk all day about monuments. What else would top your list in terms of things you were involved with that have made a difference? Monuments, obviously, a big one.
Well, the two that come to mind in my second stint in the Senate are solar power. I was the floor leader for the bill that brought about solar power to South Carolina. Prior to passage of that bill, if you wanted to use solar panels, you could not sell the excess electricity back onto the grid in order to minimize the cost of those panels or mitigate the cost. And you also, if you wanted to do any type of solar field, you had to be regulated like a utility, which was quite cumbersome. So South Carolina was way behind neighboring states of North Carolina and Georgia with regard to solar development. But with passage of the Solar Act in 2014, it opened South Carolina up, you know, not only to rooftop solar, but also to solar fields. And so since then, you know, South Carolina has been a leader in solar power growth, and as we should be. We have just as much sunshine as North Carolina, Georgia. And it's helped, you know, thousands of people reduce their power bill. In fact, I put solar panels on my business in Lancaster, and it's reduced in the summertime, it's reduced you know, our electricity cost by 85%.
Whew.
So,
well, you must have figured the payback on the investment for that. How many years?
Well, that's interesting. You know, with tax credits and bonus depreciation, which really is not something that's, you know, particular to solar power, but with tax credits and bonus depreciation, you know, Section 179 depreciation, you know, the payback on it is about 4.5 to 5 years, and
oh,
then
wow.
It's free power after that.
Whew. Good decision.
Right.
All right, what would be number three on your list?
Well, I think probably the thing that I've worked on and had the most impact for South Carolinians in the aggregate would be the bill 3-4 years ago to increase the fuel tax. And that's something I campaigned on when I campaigned to come back to the Senate, was raising the gas tax. And obviously, as a Republican, you increase in taxes is not popular, but I think 80% of the people, once it was explained to them, if they didn't already know, they get the fuel tax hadn't increased in 30 years, that was the reason that our roads were falling into disrepair. And so, of course, I worked closely with Gary Simrell here in Rock Hill, who was a floor leader in the House on that, and it was a tough fight. It took probably 3 years of debate to get the bill through the Senate. The House was more reasonable, but the Senate was a sticking point. And I think, you know, we're seeing now the benefits of that, and we'll continue to see it over the next decade. It's slower than I would like, but it was necessary, and the fuel tax has increased 8 cents now. I don't think anybody really has noticed that, because as we predicted, proponents of the bill, you know, fuel taxes or fuel costs because of fracking and abundance of oil in the United States now are going to stay low, barring some, you know, outside event. So, you know, the decline in fuel cost has certainly mitigated the tax increase. It'll go up another 4 cents to 12 cents per gallon over the next couple of years, but certainly necessary to do what's needed to keep our roads.
So the whole idea was we were not keeping pace with the work that needed to be done on roads, whether it be new roads or repairing existing roads. And the DOT always said we don't have enough money to do it. There was a lot of argument about that in terms of, was the DOT structured properly to get things done? So with all that being said, here we are 8 cents into a 12-cent tax, 2 pennies a year. Can we really, you know, as a legislator, can you pinpoint where, yes, this money is producing the result we wanted it to produce?
Yes, I think so, especially with regard to resurfacing. Resurfacing is easier to get the money out of the chute and spent than new projects. A frustrating thing with regard to new projects and expanding roads is the regulatory environment that we are in. And, of course, the Trump administration recently announced changes to streamline that regulatory environment. But things like the Fort Mill bypass, you know, take far too long to get done than they should. But I don't think people really, unless you just explain to them, don't really understand how expensive it is to expand roads. For example, to expand the interstate by two lanes costs $20 million a mile, sometimes as much as, you know, $30 million a mile. So it's prohibitively expensive and impossible without, you know, at least increasing the fuel tax to accommodate for inflation. Another thing that has to be taken into account is that last time a fuel tax was increased, cars got, you know, only half the mileage that they do today. So now they're using the roads twice as much for half as much money, which of course increases deterioration. But safety improvements was a big part. The first money that came was put to use out of the fuel tax was the safety improvements. South Carolina, of course, has the deadliest secondary roads in the country. So, you know, the guardrails and other safety improvements that you've seen go up in the last several years have come from the fuel tax, resurfacing, and then major projects like a new interchange at 160, which is going to cost, you know, in the hundreds of millions of dollars, be funded by it, and then, you know, expansion all along I-85. You've seen I-85 is being improved from here to the state line.
Yeah, the interstate that never stops being improved, I-85. It's just always working on it.
But there's still not enough money with the fuel tax increase to expand I-95, which, of course, is six lanes in Georgia and North Carolina, but only four. I mean, just to expand the bridge over the lake at Santee, it's going to cost $1 billion.
Whoo! Really? My gosh. All righty. So, well, I'll tell you what, we're going to go ahead and take our mid-program break. Remind everybody that you are listening to Straight Talk live from Substation 2. Sherry Road across from Winthrop. presented by Founders Federal Credit Union. Relax, you're with Founders. Our thanks to our co-sponsor today, Anderson Griggs Investments in Old Town Rock Hill. Common sense, intelligent advice for conservative investors online at AndersonGriggs.com. And our thanks to Good Pharmacy, your hometown pharmacy, Ebenezer Road to Camden Avenue in Rock Hill. And, of course, if you know anything about Substation 2, Cherry Road across from Winthrop, we do fresh subs and salads 7 days a week. Right before your eyes, the magical way we do it is right there on the cue card, the white letters on the green shirt, and here we go. 1, 2, 3. Slice, slice, slice. Garden, garden, garden. Back after these words.
If it's 12:30, it's Straight Talk on WRHI.
Need extra cash? Relax. Founders has personal loans for all needs. Whether you're knocking off items from your quarantine home renovation list or consolidating existing debt, there's a loan for you. Our flexible loan options offer low rates to give you the confidence you need. Visit relaxjoinfounders.com to see if you qualify for membership. Founders Federal Credit Union is federally insured by NCUA.
My concern is let's not let fear of COVID cloud people's judgment about their health. We don't want people sitting at home with heart attacks, stroke. Those things are life-threatening.
Piedmont Medical Center Chief Executive Officer Mark Nosaka expressing his concern about those who fear coming to the ER.
People are still going to have heart disease. They're still going to have heart attacks. They're still going to need heart surgery. And we're providing all those services while we're protecting people from COVID.
Piedmont Medical Center, a community built on care.
This is Danny Rogers with Paul Davis Restoration and Remodeling. If your home or business is damaged by water, fire, storm, or mold, Paul Davis is here to help. We're staffed with over 35 trained and certified professionals to handle any type of property damage. Our team mission is to provide extraordinary care while serving our neighbors in their time of need. Whether you need repairs in one room or rebuild a whole home, Paul Davis is here to help. Find us online at pauldavisrockhill.com.
This is Charlie Ruffalo. I want to personally thank everyone for supporting Substation 2 during this pandemic. This has not been an easy time for many of us, but you keep coming back day after day for our fresh subs and salads, and that has helped us keep the doors open and our employees on the payroll. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Rock Hill and York County, for supporting Substation 2 these past 34 years, and especially now. Substation 2 really loves you. Cherry Road across from Winthrop.
Straight Talk continues now on WRHI. Brought to you by Founders Federal Credit Union. Relax, you're with Founders.
State Senator Greg Gregory is with us today. He is beginning to wrap up a 26-year career down at the State Senate, which he did in two fell swoops, 16 years, and then came back and did another 10 years after taking a short sabbatical. As he said, I had nothing better to do when there was a recession, so I ran for office again. You've had a lot of accomplishments. Are there things that you were working on that you didn't get across the goal line that you just regret that they didn't happen?
The most disappointing would be something that's still pending, which is legislation to strengthen requirements to be able to purchase a weapon. This pertains to the Charleston loophole, which came about, a phrase that came about after the Charleston massacre. And of course, Clementa Pinckney was a good friend of mine. He was my desk mate when I came back to the Senate. Probably the nicest person that, you know, I've ever had the pleasure of knowing. And he was killed by Dylan Roof, who got his gun illegally. He should not have been able to purchase a weapon because he had a pending drug charge. But because the FBI couldn't figure out whether or not he should have been allowed to buy the weapon, the law is that unless the FBI objects the NICS database within 3 days, and it's a gun dealer's discretion to sell that weapon, which a gun dealer did in this case. Complicated issue, but what we've been trying to do is to kind of close that loophole, because right now if you're charged with a crime or convicted of a crime that prevents one from purchasing a weapon through legal channels, then you still have a 30-day window there that has to be reported to the database. So we've been trying to move that up to just 5 days, because there are a lot of people that get weapons could be been charged or convicted of CDV, criminal domestic violence, and other crimes that should not be able to purchase those weapons. But you would think that would be easy, but it's not. And as anything gun-related is very difficult to get through. But I've also, proposed a ban on expanded magazines. I mean, I don't see a reason why anybody needs more than 10 or 11 bullets in a gun. I don't think that if you're trying to defend yourself, you're going to be able to do it just as adequately with 10 or 11 bullets as you're going to be with 30. But the problem with 30 or 100, as in the case with the mass shooting in Dayton where the guy had a 100-round magazine, which is frankly a weapon of war, he was able to shoot, I don't know how many people. The police put him down within 9 or 10 seconds, I think, but he still shot, a bunch of people in that time. And, of course, Las Vegas, where you had using extended magazines that shot 500-and-something people, in a matter of 8 or 9 minutes. There's no reason, for those weapons of war to be available to the public.
It's amazing. What's it called? Common sense? Common sense. Right. That's all you need is some common sense, and you get these issues resolved. Anything else that you would you wished had gotten over the goal line, no pun intended?
That's the only thing that comes to mind right off the bat. I may think of something later, but I've had a lot of bills that I have introduced, as most people who, the bills didn't pass or they got
passed. It's not easy. I mean, it's
another version.
Well, they say watching the sausage being made is not something pretty.
No, it's not. I think I'd like to have some things I've worked on, stronger laws against litter, which we, not been able to do is another difficult issue. But litter, I think, is a defining problem of South Carolina. Throughout the Southeast, you can go.
I think former coach of the Gamecocks in Columbia said it the best when he said, South Carolinians have the cleanest cars in the country because they throw all the trash out on the road. Yeah, I got
exactly.
Yep. So you were involved, as everybody in the local delegation up here, with probably the biggest economic development issue that we've had here in the history of the county. With the Carolina Panthers, that was not an easy sell for you, particularly in the Senate, correct?
Yeah, it was a difficult sell in the Senate. Senator Clymer and I had to work hard to get the votes in the Senate, and it was touch and go for a while. But I think that the Panthers will be a boon to Rock Hill. The NFL is the most important sports franchise in the world. Broadcast are worldwide, and I think that once the facility is built, any broadcast concerning the Panthers is going to be generated from Rock Hill, South Carolina, tagline, and broadcast worldwide. And I really don't think you can buy that type of publicity, but I think that's going to be money well spent. The legislators tend to see Lancaster and York County as being part of North Carolina, and we never always had to fight for what we get up here because we're not really seen as part of South Carolina proper. There's a lot of opposition, especially among Republicans in the Senate, to spending public dollars to bring an NFL franchise headquarters to York County. But I think just the interchange alone is worth it. I mean, interchange is, everybody knows the interchange is way overdue. Salinese Road is the only road in the state in which in the morning there are more cars on the road trying to get on the interstate than there are cars on the interstate. So, I mean, just for the sake of getting the interchange, I think the deal is worth it.
So now, what am I trying to say here? You're stepping out, and your term will end at the end of the year. The Republican nominee is Michael Johnson, who's a former chair, current chair of the York County Council. Have you all had any conversations about this Panther thing? Because he voted against it as far as York County's participation in this thing, and you all worked very hard to get it.
Right.
Have you all conversed about that at all?
No, actually, I never talked to Michael about that. I did endorse him in the primary, and I think that he'll certainly win the seat in November. He does have Democrat opposition. But Michael and I, over the years that he's been on school board or county council, certainly hadn't agreed on every issue, but he's certainly a reasonable person who can think for himself and puts a lot of thought, you know, into his positions. I think he'll be a great senator for District 16. I'm sad that Lancaster County will no longer have a resident senator. Really, for the first time in 208 years, there's been a resident senator from Lancaster. But District 16 is largely divided between the two counties, and folks chose Michael. But I think that he'll do a good job for both counties.
And with the census underway, you know that district is going to change again.
Right.
I mean, because all we're doing is growing.
Well, I think the district that Senator Clymer represents, the one adjacent one I represent, and then the one that Tom Davis represents in Buford, are the three fastest growing Senate districts in the state by far. Each district probably has 20,000 more people in it than should be allowed or will be allowed after redistricting. So each district is going to have to jettison a lot of people, and will contract geographically, and will, in the case of the two York County districts, contract towards the North Carolina line. It's interesting. South Carolina used to have one senator for each county. You probably remember that.
And wow.
After the Voting Rights Act, we went to single-member districts, and that caused the districts to be even number of people to be in each district, just as there are in the House. I think that's been detrimental to the state, because you have many counties now that don't have a resident senator or never will have a resident senator. And you have some senators trying to represent six counties, and you have some counties with six senators. So I don't think it's been a good thing for the state. And the purpose was to elect more minority senators, but truth of the matter is that if we went back to one senator for each county, you'd probably still have the same number of minority senators. So I don't know that it's really served any good purpose, but it is what it is. And I think Lancaster, probably that district will probably be collapsed into Fort Mill and Indian Land, and then Lancaster will be in a district with Kershaw County.
I mean, you're looking at 5 million people in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And you just do the math. I mean, how many senators do we have now?
46.
46. So divided, that's
120 or so per district. This one's probably got 140 in it or something.
So with about 30 seconds left, if you were able to stand up there before your brethren in the state senate and say, I just have a few parting words for you as you leave after 26 years, what would you say to them?
Well, I think the most important thing is to strive to get along, to work for the betterment of the state and not for yourself individually. The Senate has always been a collegial body. South Carolina is a small state. Some of us have fathers who served together, who are friends, going back generations. And the partisan politics that we see and experience in Washington is not really taken root to a great extent in the Senate, although it is growing.
State Senator Greg Gregory, thank you for all that you've done. I can't believe after all these years, we may not be across this table again, unless you decide to do a three-peat.
Right.
Not going to happen. All right. And that's going to wrap up our Straight Talk program, live from Substation 2, Cherry Road across from Winthrop, presented by Founders Federal Credit Union. Relax, you're with Founders. Our thanks to our co-sponsor, Anderson Griggs Investments at Old Town Rock Hill. Common sense, intelligent advice for conservative investors, online at AndersonGriggs.com. And, of course, we broadcast live from Substation 2, Cherry Road across from Winthrop. Fresh subs and salads prepared right before your eyes 7 days a week. State Representative, Randy Ligon has just rolled in. He's going to lead us in the chant. Are you ready, Randy? One, two, three. Slice, slice, slice. Garden, garden, garden. Have a wonderful day. We'll see you on the radio tomorrow. Bye.